So I would like to start speaking fairly quickly because we only actually have a couple of hours here. And then we have to make our way back to Govardhan. We're very fortunate. We're leaving one extraordinary place to return to another one. So what I would like to do, and I'm hoping that everybody here is okay with this, is that we will walk, we will hear something of the pastimes of this particular place in Javad, and then we will walk through the village and we'll come to the outskirts of the village and we will walk a path to Ter Kadamba, where we, some of us had our japa, our 64 rounds day. We'll walk to Ter Kadamba and we'll pick up the buses in Ter Kadamba. So I would like to share with you, before we begin, some very, very interesting quotes. But I would like to share with you, first of all, what I found when I was researching this pastime that we were performing in the evening of stealing the gopis' clothes. I had for myself, and I'm sure that if any of you are listening carefully, there were so many questions. What about this? And how come that? And why this? And where? And so many questions would come. So when I was preparing, I was thinking that if I have so many questions, then there's a good chance that other people are going to ask me questions, and I'm going to have to find out the answers to my questions to be able to answer them. So I was reading here and there, trying to find some elements that would be helpful in understanding this pastime. Now, as fate would have it, because this is a new technology for me, and because of the sunlight, I'm not able to see it. Last night I collected together all these quotes and turned them into PDFs so that they were readable, and put them on this little machine, but right now the sun is playing tricks with us. Okay, I'm going to continue without this, but what I would like to say is when we go back, if anyone would like, it's okay, thank you. If anyone would like to, I will share with them some very, very good quotes that help us to understand how we're proceeding with this pastime. Technology, when you come to Vrindavan, technology is it really doesn't have a place here. It's only because it's so necessary to us in our day-by-day life in the rest of the world that we rely upon it. But you'll notice that people here, they usually write things down with a pen and paper, and this is their way of collection. So I found in a book called The Bhagavat, It's Life and Teachings, It's Ethics, a book by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, where he explains something that's very, very simple. So the first one was that there's a very subtle connection between an object and its shadow. We all sort of know this, but we never think about it. That, for example, this box is here, and there is a shadow that connects directly to the box. And this is something that monkeys are here. Baba. This is Vrindavan.
Monkey, Bhavani.
So this connection between an object and its shadow is the same thing. There's a connection between the material world and the spiritual world. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that you can only understand the spiritual world by observing the material world. So this is a little bit, seems back the front to us, not how we have been trained. But he explains it in a way that you observe the material world, you get a shadow of an idea of something that exists in reality. So then I had a very interesting quote where Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur is explaining how most people consider religion, spirituality, equal to morality. That the purpose of religion is to make people moral, right? Everyone knows that. But actually, this is not the purpose of religion. He explains that morality is a kind of a restricting policy that is meant to be put in place because the people are tending to be immoral. So because they're immoral, we need morality. We say, you don't do this, do this, do that. So some people, perhaps even including ourselves, we carry this conception of the link between morality and religion when we come into the Holy Dham. And here, this concept of morality, actually, he says, it becomes harmful. So how could it become harmful? This is the way we regulate and make a respectable society. And the answer is, it becomes harmful because there is no impurity on the transcendental plane. So there is no morality on that plane as we know it, as we understand right and wrong, good and bad. That's not there in the spiritual world. So we're looking at the shadow and we're trying to understand something of the reality from the shadow. But we're also cautioned, be careful, don't forget, this is the shadow. You're dealing with the shadow. So then I found a very nice quote where Srila Prabhupada was explaining in one lecture how it's quite natural. Now this again, it sort of shakes our moral standards, but he said it's quite natural that a man looks for another woman other than his wife. That's quite normal and natural. It's not acceptable, but it happens all the time. So he asks, why does this happen unless this conception is actually there also within the spiritual world? If the reality did not have that concept within it, then it would not be there in the shadow. Now these are very simple points, but if we take them into our thinking in a deep way, they might even confuse us. I know at different times they confuse me, because I truly believe that we're trying to make the world moral and ethically correct by becoming devotees. And I think in that way because outside in the world, that's very much part of our preaching. But when we come to Braj, we have to learn to step over a threshold and accept a different quality of values. So I was thinking how this is that we should have to accept a different quality of values. And the thought came to me. One time I was in an airport with my husband, and there was an unusual looking young man standing there. And he looked unusually self-confident and relaxed. And as my husband and I walked past, he turned to my husband and he said, "Do you know?" He was a stranger, we didn't know him. He said, "Do you know, when I'm in an airport, it's sort of boring. So what I do is," and he reached in his pocket and he took out some balls. He said, "I juggle." It was an unusual exchange in an airport of all places. And he starts juggling these balls. And he's juggling balls and balls and balls up and down, up and down. And then he looks at my husband and says, "Do you know how to juggle?" And my husband goes, he wasn't quite ready for this. And he hands him the balls in a very spontaneous way. He says, "It's easy. It's very easy. Look, you just look this way when you're throwing it and that way when you're catching it. And you put your hands like this. Try." And of course my husband, up they went and down on the floor, because he's never juggled balls in his life before, especially not in an airport. So the man took the balls back and he kept talking and juggling the balls in a very relaxed way. And then he looked at his watch and said, "Oh, I have to go. Nice meeting you," and shook our hands, put his balls away, and off he went. And I was thinking, what did I learn from that? And what I thought later was that if you give me one ball, everybody here, you can juggle one ball. It's not so hard. You throw it up in the air, however you want. Just throw it up in the air, and then you put your hand underneath and it comes down. And that's not so hard. It may take a little bit of coordination, but it's not so hard. So when you get used to throwing one ball up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, then somebody might say, if they were your teacher, now you should try two balls. Now that's also not so hard because you've got one hand, one hand, one hand, one hand, and you could start to feel like I'm actually a good juggler because I go up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. I'm really good at this. I'm quite proud of myself how quickly I learned this. But then they say, now here's another ball. Try three balls. And all of a sudden, you find yourself in a different dimension of experience, beyond your natural power of control. Now you require a teacher and some skill, because you have to, in your mind, be calculating all the time, three balls going up and down, with only two hands and one brain. So when we're out in the material world, day-by-day life, we have one thing that we have to consider. How to increase our Krishna consciousness. How to act in the world and increase... Sorry, we have two things to consider. How to act in the world properly and how to maintain and increase our Krishna consciousness. And an ordinary materialistic person has only one thing to balance. Their material life. They're just looking how to make money, how to be successful, how to have a wonderful family life, how to have the best possible wife that they could have, how to have money in store for the grandchildren and the great-great-grandchildren and the great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren as well, and how to put their wealth in the best possible way and have 5 or 10 houses if possible. And this is their whole meditation. They're one-minded with their one ball, up and down, up and down, up and down. And we struggle with our two balls, how to get our Krishna consciousness to go up and not come down, and how to get our material life also moving successfully. But when you come to the Dhamma, if you come to the Dhamma with a real mentality of being in the Dhamma and not just kind of being somewhere, you're going to be asked to juggle three balls. And if you don't know how to do it, you will struggle with it. And perhaps, like my husband, you might even drop them on the floor. So the third ball, the one that is added that makes it not as easy as it all seemed, is that you have to understand that everything here that you can see with your ordinary eyes and everything that you cannot see at all, everything here is designed only for the pleasure of one person, Krishna. Everything. Now, we may have gotten that theoretically in place, and it may have helped us in our life, so our Krishna consciousness and our life are going well. But when we come to the Dhamma, we have to concentrate on the third ball. We have to understand that it isn't about us when we come to the Dhamma. It's not about what we can achieve when we come here. It's not about our qualification when we come here. It's about Krishna's being pleased with us. So this place in Javat, this is a mysterious place, as I told you all, and we're very, very, very fortunate to be here today. Because this is not a place that's regularly, so regularly visited. Many people all over India, they'll come to Nandagram, and they'll come to Varshana, and they'll go to Gokul, and they'll go to some other places, Vrindavan, they'll go there, they'll go to Vamsivat, they'll go to the Rasastali, and they'll offer their obeisances and they will feel very happy. No matter what their background or their sampradaya or anything else, they'll go to these places because these places are known and adored by everyone. But Javat is a secret place. It's a place that is specifically relevant for those who are followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. So it's important when you come to Vrindavan to understand that not every Vaishnava you meet has the same basic understanding of the same things that we do. And that is not a fault on their behalf. It's not something that we should try to alter and improve upon. That's actually the reality, because they are Vaishnavas who are approaching Krishna perhaps through a different line of teachings. And we're speaking of Vaishnavas here, not impersonalists who have no proper understanding of anything. But those who are Vaishnavas, for example, in the Sri Sampradaya, their worship is of Lakshmi Narayan in the Dasya Ras. They're Suda Dasya devotees, perfect in their mood of service. So they don't come here. They go to other places which are favorite to their hearts. And likewise in the Balavacharya also, they don't regularly come here. Mostly the people who come here have some contact with the Gaudiya line. And that's because it was Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and then his line of followers who elaborated on the idea that Krishna, beyond morality, beyond Radha Krishna on the altar, beyond Radha and Krishna who are married, beyond that, Krishna is living in Nandagram and Radharani is living here under the care of her in-laws, which are actually Jatila, and Kutila is her sister-in-law, and Abhimanyu, who is her, quote-unquote, husband. Now, as fate would have it, I cannot read you any of the references I have, but as I said, we can share when we go back to Govardhan. But Abhimanyu, he's not a real concrete husband, as we would all have in this world. This is not a case of a real, like the Satan and God, that Abhimanyu, somehow he got Radharani instead of Krishna. There's nothing like that here, because we go back to our basic premise. Third ball, everything here is arranged only for the pleasure of Krishna, nobody else. Everyone is serving Krishna according to their own individual role and mood. So one day Krishna was out in the fields with the cowherd boys, and he was thinking of Radha, because in his Naralila, Naralila means when he comes here, he appears on this earthly plane, and he appears like an ordinary person with a birth, with a childhood, with a mother and a father and a house and activities of play. So Krishna, in his Naralila, he has not actually met with Radha at all, but he has heard about her, and he's thinking about her all the time. And Radha, who is in Varshana, she is also all the time thinking about Krishna, because everybody knows that Krishna is the handsome son of Nanda Maharaj. And Krishna's with the cowherd boys and they're playing happily together. And Purnamasi comes. Now you must all understand who Purnamasi is if you want to understand anything in Vrindavan. Purnamasi is Yoga Maya. Yoga Maya means the transcendental, extraordinary pastime energy that creates union. Union between Krishna and Radha, and union between ourselves and Radha and Krishna. So the gopis we hear, they're all praying to Purnamasi in the form of Katyayani, saying, please, we want to marry Krishna. So Purnamasi comes, And Krishna is there, and he calls her, "Oh, noble lady, welcome, welcome." And she says, "Oh, young king, prince of Braj, please accept a gift from me." And she has with her a plate of laddus. And he says, "Oh, noble lady, from where have these come?" And she says, "Oh, this is the prasad from the marriage." And Krishna says, "Oh, please tell me what marriage." And she says, "Oh, you have not heard? This is the prasad from the marriage of Radha and Abhimanyu." And Krishna freezes. He doesn't want to take those laddus. So our hearts go, "Oh!" Naturally, because we're following the mood. We are the shadow. This is the reality. So Krishna is thinking, "Oh, what has happened? How has this happened?" Now let me tell you how it happened. This is also very important. You see, Mother Yasoda and Kirtida, Radharani's mother, they're like intimate best friends. And since Radha was a baby, and since Krishna was a young baby boy, they were dreaming of the day when Radha would marry Krishna. And one day, as they were growing up and they were starting to become of an age where it was suitable to make a marriage agreement, Radha was in Nandagram and Yasoda saw her and she called her aside. And Radha was very shy, just as if Yasoda was her mother-in-law. She was very shy and covered up. And Yasoda spontaneously couldn't help herself. She took some turmeric and oil and she rubbed it on Radha's hands. And Radha's hands were now yellow. Now this was very significant, because this is how you would indicate an acceptance of a proposal of marriage. There hadn't been a proposal of marriage. But she lost herself and she decided that she was going to say, "Yes, we want marriage." And so Radha, her hands were yellow, and she went back to Varshana. She hid her hands because she was very shy. And she went to one pukur, one lake, and she washed her hands very carefully because she was afraid. What would she say to her mother? And the water became a beautiful golden color. And somebody nearby saw this. And they went secretly and they told what they had seen. And when Radha came home, then her family were overjoyed. This is what they had always wanted. And so what they did was, they prepared a jeweled bullock cart, something extraordinary that you don't see nowadays. And they filled it up with jewels and necklaces and beautiful things. And they called some of their important servants and they said, "Take this down the road." As we drove from Varshana to Nandagram, then round the corner to here. They said, "Take this immediately to Nanda Baba." So they did. And when they arrived with the cart of offering to say, "We accepted your marriage proposal," Nanda Maharaj was so happy, he was beside himself. This is what everyone in Vrindavan wanted. And so then he arranged to send back a suitable offering, and an offering was sent back, which more or less confirmed the whole thing. And there was only one thing lacking, and that was that to do anything in Vrindavan, everyone must, no one was an exception to this rule. Everyone must get the approval of Purnamasi. Because everybody knew Bhagavati Purnamasi, she is the last say. She is the guru of all the Brajabasis. So you must check with her to finalize the whole thing. So they called her and they explained the whole situation. And she also became very happy. She said, "This is wonderful. I will consult the astrology and see when this can happen." And then she left and she went back to her place and she felt something is not correct here. Something is not right. This is actually not the mood of Vrindavan. If Radha and Krishna get married, then the mood, the taste, the experience will be just like in Dwarka, where Krishna is married to Rukmini and has 100 sons, and all the sons are wonderful boys, and everything is perfect. It's the perfect marriage. And a lot of people would say, that's a wonderful place. I would love to go to Dwarka. It sounds so ideal. The ethics and morality are so high. But in Vrindavan, that's not the mood or the taste of Vrindavan. Now, if you have a history or a recurrent habit of watching movies, and you like to find out what are the most popular movies and go and see them, then you will notice there are certain characteristics that make up a good movie. And one of them is that there has to be some obstacle that the hero has to surmount in order to get the heroine. If he sort of walks into a room, she's sitting there, he says, hello, she says, hello, they say, would you like to get married? Yes, they get married. It would be so boring. It would be like, you know what it would be like? It would be like when people show you their slides of their family experience. They say, this is my auntie, this is my uncle, we went on a holiday, it was so much fun, we saw the Eiffel Tower, we did this, we did that. And the people who are watching are yawning. Because it's only exciting to the person who was there, and only a certain amount exciting to them, but to everybody else it's a little bit boring. Because there's no excitement there. Because it was predictable. We did this, we did this, we did that. And for anyone who's married or been married, you know what marriage is like. You know what marriage is like. I mean, you both rely on each other all the time, and you say, did you take out the garbage? No. Oh, you're supposed to do it. I told you to do it. Oh, dear. And then you argue, and it's a trifle boring. To be honest, it's more than a trifle boring. And he's supposed to do what I say, and she's supposed to do what I say. And that's the characteristics of the Swakya Ras. Of course, we've made fun of them, but this is the characteristic of Swakya Ras. And then that can come up to the pinnacle of, you could say, Lakshmi Narayan or Rukmini Krishna. But still, that's not what's meant to be experienced in Vrindavan. So Purnamasi thought very carefully here. And she returned to Nanda Maharaj, and she returned to Kirtida and Vishabhanu Maharaj, and she said to them both, this is not a good time for marriage. If this couple marry now, the marriage will break. This is not a good time for marriage. We should wait, and I will look at everything again later. Oh, imagine how everybody felt. They were so disappointed, but they had to listen to Purnamasi. And without fail, she came here to Javat, and she told Jyotila Dasi, without any arrangement other than that, she said, your son Abhimanyu should marry Radharani tomorrow. And she had to do it. And so there, the marriage was arranged, it was cut. Radha and Krishna, no. So then, Vrishabhanu Maharaj, he arranged for a beautiful palace to be built here in Javat. And because Abhimanyu is not a real husband, he's not a competitor to Krishna, there is only one person who enjoys in Vrindavan, and that's Krishna, the third ball. It's Krishna. Everything belongs to Krishna here. Everything is for his pleasure. So therefore, Abhimanyu is sort of like a shadowy character. He never even crosses Radharani's shadow. He hardly even talks to her, maybe from a distance. And he's quite shy. So he lives here in the place of Jodhila and Kutila, and Srimati Radharani's palace was just almost nearby. And Radha lives in the palace with her girlfriends, who, by the arrangement of Purnamasi, are all married. Even the young girls, they're married, and mostly they're all married here in Javat. All of them got married in Javat. And this is to nourish this Parakiya Ras, this exciting situation where the Supreme Personality, whom everything is meant for his pleasure, can experience the pleasure of surmounting all kinds of yogamayic obstacles to meet with Radha. And Radha can show her transcendental greatness of her love by walking through fire, if necessary, to meet with Krishna. And so the morality, immorality concept that's so necessary in material dealings, it becomes a stumbling block here in Vrindavan. I will add that that doesn't mean that we should give up morality and take up immorality for ourselves. This is another point that's very interesting to note. And that is that when people in general who think the material world is reality, when they hear these pastimes, they live in the material world, they think, oh, look at this man, he's so adulterous. He's getting to deal with so many women in such a wanton, immoral way. And they have two different responses, one or the other. And one is, they think, this is disgusting. This whole Hindu Krishna legend, mythology is absolutely disgusting. If this becomes known to the people at large, it will just create rampant immorality amongst the people. And therefore, we should turn them all into Christians. And this is how the Christian missionaries came to India and Bangladesh and made so many Christian followers. They pointed to these pastimes and said, could you worship such an immoral God? So even I found in myself sometimes these thoughts come in when I'm mixing with the world a little too much. I look over at these pastimes and think, oh, this is not actually so good. And then I have to remember, oh, you've switched, you've dropped the third ball. You're just thinking now as a moralist. You have to come back to the principle of what is Vrindavan if you wish to enter. And there's another threshold, another problem, which many people also stumble over. And that is that they say, well, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, whatever a great man does, common men should follow in his footsteps. So, this is very nice. I like this. This Parakiya Ras is very nice. And they concoct all kinds of ways which they hope to follow in the footsteps of Krishna. And so these two misunderstandings come from misunderstanding the nature of the spirit in relationship to matter. And although Srila Jiva Goswami, he saw these risks and dangers after Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had left this world and after the Goswamis Rupa and Sanatan, who had written the theology, so much of what they had heard from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they had written this down. And then Srila Jiva Goswami, who was a young man at that time, he was to write down the official philosophy of what is Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And so he wrote in a very mysterious way. And only those who have the proper training, training doesn't mean that you have to go to the university, but it means you have to follow the right, the people with the proper understanding. Only those people can understand what Srila Jiva Goswami is doing. because in his Gopal Champu, which is a well-known work, he describes very, very descriptively how Krishna comes back and marries all the gopis. And then they all leave and they go to Goloka Vrindavan together, and how up in Goloka Vrindavan there is no Parakiya Ras. He did this for a specific purpose, to protect the people who were immature and didn't understand properly from either of these two mistakes. Either of thinking, oh, we should also enjoy with other men's wives, or thinking, this is disgusting. So to protect the line, so it should not be misunderstood in either of these ways, he created, you could say, almost like a smoke screen. It's true and it's not true, what he has written. He has done it purposefully. It's like if I put up a barrier, if I put up a curtain or a barrier in front of the deities because I'm making an offering. At that time, you can't see behind the barrier. But the barrier or the curtain is not meant to be there all the time. It has a purpose in being there. So he had a purpose in writing in this way. And so when reading his work, if one requires the help of somebody who can explain which passages are aligned with the teachings of Rupa and Sanatan, and which passages he has put there like a barrier for unqualified people. So he says himself, at the end of the commentary, he writes on the book of Rupa Goswami called Ujjala Nilamani, which explains all about the different ingredients that make up Krishna's loving pastimes. At the end of the book, he makes one comment where he says, whatever I say that is in the line, it's parallel to the teachings of Rupa and Sanatan, that is what I believe. And whatever else is there, is there. So you can work it out yourself. So by this I'm telling you all and telling myself, Vrindavan is a mysterious land. It's a very mysterious land. Because, why? Because third ball means? Only one person. Everyone is serving the happiness of one person. Even Jyotila and Kutila are serving Krishna's happiness. They increase the excitement and the taste of the rasa of Krishna and Radha meeting. And everyone is under the control of Yoga Maya, a powerful energy to bring together Radha and Krishna. So sometimes there are pastimes where Jyotila and Kutila staying here, they want to engage Radha and the other girlfriends of hers in household duties like making the goba patties and rolling the goba and all the things that you see here in this village, but not of course on the same way, in the same kind of dusty way that we see. But interestingly enough, the same things that are going on here in a village were going on thousands of years ago in a village. That is why I suggested to you, when you're going in the vehicles, look to the things that are old. Don't look at the things that are new. Don't stop your attention on the new college that they've just put in for engineering and doctor, but look at the things that the people are doing in a natural, organic way. And it will give you the shadow experience of what takes place in the village of Vrindavan. So sometimes Radharani is feeling so much heat, she wants to meet with Krishna. And daily she has been ordered, Purnamasi made an arrangement and ordered Jyotila, daily Radha must worship Surya Dev, the sun god, for the benefit of your family. You will get cows and wealth and good sons And everything that an honest village person desires, if your daughter-in-law worships Surya Dev just near Radhakund every day. And so with Jyotila's permission, she sent, now you must go and do your Surya Puja. And of course, when she gets out of Javat and she walks from here towards Suryakund, who do you think she should meet? Sometimes she first meets Vrinda Devi, or she meets one of the cowherd boys, or she sends some of her girlfriends along to find out where is Krishna. And they have mysteriously beautiful pastimes every day. And regularly at around about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Jyotila sets out herself to make sure that that Surya Puja has been done properly. So she takes her stick and off she goes. And when she gets there, she looks around and she sees Radha is there, but there's no pujari. There's no brahmana here to do the worship of Surya Dev. And she often comes with a very nice young girl. Her name is Kundalata. And Kundalata is from Nandagram. And Kundalata happens to be the cousin of Krishna. But as far as Jyotila knows, Kundalata is a very honest girl. She's got very high dharma. Her pativrata is so high. She's such a good person that Kundalata is totally trustworthy. Kundalata will never, never, never place Radharani in the hands of Krishna. So she comes with Kundalata and asks Kundalata, see if you can find a Brahmin somewhere here to do the puja. And Kundalata goes into the nearby area and finds this beautiful, dark-complexioned Brahmana. And he has a Brahmin student with him who's a little fat, little short-necked, a little chubby, and his name is Madhu. And here comes this beautiful, handsome Brahmana. And when he arrives, Jyotila looks at him and thinks, my goodness, he looks wonderful. And she asks him many questions just to make sure that he's suitable. And he looks a little down on Jyotila because she's from the village. And he's from Mathura. He's a Brahmin by caste. So he looks at her a little bit like he's not sure if he wants to do this puja. But she begs him and begs him and begs him and begs him, and he agrees. And so he starts chanting these mantras. And the gopis, by the way, they're all covered up now because their mother-in-law is there. But you know, have you seen the ladies when they do this? They make a little hole, and they look through the little hole, and their head is fully covered up, but there's a little hole, so they're looking to see what's going on. So in that way, they look and they all think. And Lalita Devi gives Radha an indication, and she says, I'm not sure about this Brahmin boy. And Radharani looks and her hair stands on end. And then the Brahmin boy is standing there smiling, and Jyotila's asking him, please chant a suitable mantras. And he chants these extraordinary mantras. And the mantras are so extraordinary, Jyotila's never heard such mantras. And she's hearing one thing, and Radharani is hearing something completely different. And Radharani is blushing. And Krishna is saying so many nice things to her. And Jyotila is hearing something different. And she even asks, where did you get these unusual mantras from? And he goes, ah, you know, you're born in the village. What do you know? You know, we have studied all these mantras in the Agamas and the Puranas and the Tantras. We can't explain these things to a village woman. She said, oh, very sorry, please continue. And every day in this way, Radha and Krishna meet. And in so many other ways. But then Jyotila says, now it's time to go, thank you. And she says to Radha, take off one of your rings and give it to this Brahmana. So Radha's a little shy, but she takes off her ring, and then she's all covered up, and she drops the ring very shyly into the hand of the Brahmana. And the Brahmana starts to tremble. Ah! And Jyotila's looking, why is he reacting like this? And come on, let's go, let's go. And so she takes the girls, and they come walking back towards Javat. And those girls who are very intelligent, young girls who know the heart of Radha and Krishna, they run behind so that they have to be called to catch up. Because every time Radha turns around to call them, she can see Krishna one more time. So everyone is thinking how to bring Radha and Krishna together, because this is the thing that is most satisfying to Krishna. So then they come back here, and Radharani feels like she has just been thrown into the deepest, darkest prison. And when she comes back here, she loses all of her energy, and she becomes burning hot. She becomes so feverish that they take things like chandan and they go to wipe them on her forehead, and it just shrivels up like as if it was on a burning flame. And then another girl comes from Nandagram to here, because there is a constant interaction between these two special places. And she says, I have the order of the Queen of Braj that Radha should cook some sweets for Krishna's afternoon meal. And all of a sudden, Radha comes back into normal state. And she begins to cook, and she has so many fires she's cooking on. And in this extremely hot little kitchen, she's as cool as if she's in the Himalayas. As soon as she is with Krishna, she is happy. And when she is not with Krishna, she is simply thinking, when can I see Krishna? When can I see Krishna? And sometimes, because Krishna, he's so playful, because of course he knows that everything in Braj is meant for his pleasure. So sometimes he even sees Jyotila. And Jyotila is his, I think, his great-great aunt or something like that. And she'll see him and she'll say, oh, you disgraceful son of the prince, the king of Braj, you destroy the purity and the morality of all the young girls in Vrindavan by your flute playing. You're such a rascal. And Krishna will say, oh, dear lady, whose breasts are like string beans. And he will start criticizing Jyotila and answering her in the most playfully disrespectful ways. And she will answer him back and tell him, don't you ever come to my place and don't you disturb my daughter-in-law. She is the only chaste girl in the whole of Braj, because she's not interested in your flute playing. She's safe because I keep an eye on her constantly. And he will ridicule Jyotila, and they go backwards and forwards. And later Krishna will turn to Madhu Mangal and he will say, do you know, I'm more happy hearing the words of Jyotila and Anne bantering backwards and forwards with her than I am when I hear people reciting the Vedas. This brings more joy to my heart than all the Vedic mantras. So this is just a little bit of an understanding of this place. And sometimes, because Krishna is so impertinent, he's so confident, and he's so adorable, sometimes he makes arrangements to come here in disguise and meet with Radharani upstairs or downstairs or somewhere here without any fear, without any concern whatsoever. So one time, Radharani was very, very angry at Krishna. And when she becomes angry with Krishna, sometimes there's a reason, sometimes there's not a reason. If it's just that she's angry and there's no serious reason, then Krishna can fall at her feet and call her so many beautiful, sweet words, and she will soften and her angry mood will change. But sometimes, because Krishna likes to see Radha angry, sometimes what he will do is he'll come and he will say, oh Radha, you are so beautiful. You remind me of the moon. And then he will say, oh, my dear Chandra, Radha. And she says, what? What were you calling me? Who were you calling me? Because she has a cousin called Chandravali, which means as beautiful as many moons. And Chandravali also likes to meet with Krishna, and Radha likes to meet with Krishna. And in a mysterious way, which is very divine, they are competitors when Krishna is present. So Krishna, this is for Krishna's pleasure, ball number three. So Krishna, he sometimes will go and meet with Chandravali, and he'll come to meet with Radha and have some sign of some red lipstick on his cheek or something that indicates that he hasn't come straight there. And Radha becomes very, very angry. And she's very, very upset. You say so many things. You say that you're loyal to me, but look at this. And she said, don't come here anymore. I don't want to see you again. And she'll march away. And Krishna then he has to think, how can I break her anger? And this is a pastime that takes place regularly in Vrindavan. Sometimes he comes as a pan seller. And he comes and he sees her somewhere and he starts talking and selling her some pan. And then somehow or other he makes an exchange and she understands that it's Krishna. And sometimes the only way he can get to her is to come here. So one day he came as a beautiful singer with a beautiful Gandhava voice. She was so beautiful, so delicate, so sweet. And she came here and she walked in and she had her veena and she was singing these beautiful songs. And all the gopis were immediately attracted to her beauty and to her singing. And they said to her, oh, beautiful girl, where do you come from? And she said, I come from Mathura. I am actually a student of Brihaspati. Actually, I beg your pardon, Kundalata comes with her. Yes, Kundalata comes with her to tell the story on her behalf and says, this is Vidyavali, and she comes from Mathura. She's a disciple of Brihaspati. Her voice is so divine that one time there was a big yajna going on in Mathura. And she was just in her room, she lives in Mathura, and she started singing the Gandhava scale. And she was singing so beautifully that Brihaspati was there because the devas were there. And Brihaspati heard her singing and said, who is singing so beautifully? And then he called for her and he said, oh, beautiful young girl, would you like to come with me to the planets of the devas, and I will teach you everything about singing like the devas sing. And so he took Vidyavali with him, and she went up to the heavenly places, and she learned every possible thing that you could learn about singing. She's just returned to Mathura, and I saw her, and I wanted to bring her to meet you, because I told her that you're also a beautiful singer, and maybe she can sing for you. And Radharani is, oh, this is so nice. And she says, Vidyavali, please sing. So Vidyavali starts to sing. And her singing is so beautiful. And Radha is, her heart is melting. And when her heart's melting, she's thinking of Krishna. And Vidyavali is singing and singing and singing. And then Radha begins to realize, this person is attracting my mind in the same way as Krishna. And then Lalita Devi, who's very shrewd, she comes a little closer and she looks at Vidyavali from a different angle. And she sees that in the skirt of Vidyavali, there's a small flute. So she goes back to Radha and she has a few words in her ear. And then Radha says, Vidyavali, you sing so beautifully. And Vidyavali says, thank you. Yeah. And Radha says, how can I reward you? And Vidyavali says, the only thing I want is that you'll be pleased with me. And Radha says, no, I have to give you more than that. And she says, no, that will be the only thing I desire. So Radha says, but you know, I want to give you something else as well. I want to give you a brand new set of clothing. And Vidyavali says, you could give them to me, give them to Kundalata. She will take them, we will take them home, and I will try them on. And Kundalata's starting to get a little bit nervous now too. And then Lalita goes and she brings a beautiful new cloth with a nice blouse and everything. And Radha says, so you can take off your blouse. And she is saying, well, no, it would be better I do that later. And Radha says, you know, we're all girls here together. So girls are not shy together. So just take off your blouse, and if you don't take it off, I'll do it myself. And then Krishna's like, no, it's okay. And then two young girls come forward, and they undo the blouse and open it up, and out falls two very large Kadamba flowers. And everyone is looking at this, aha! And Krishna's standing there, he's thinking, I should leave now. And then they start laughing, and they're all laughing and laughing, and they're rolling around laughing at Krishna. And Krishna's looking rather embarrassed, and he takes his Kadamba flowers and he puts them back in place, and he does everything back nicely, and he runs downstairs here, and he comes to where Jyotila and Kutila are. At least Jyotila was there, and she throws herself on the ground. And crying. Jyotila, my gosh, what's wrong? She sees this beautiful girl crying her eyes out. What's wrong? She picks her up. What's wrong? And she cries and cries and she can hardly speak. And finally she says, you know, I'm Radharani's cousin. And we had a big fight. And she's angry with me. And Jyotila says, no, she can't be angry at you. You're just young girls. You can't take anything like this seriously. Young girls fight and make up. And she's crying and she says, I came all the way from Varshana to see my cousin, and now she's told me to leave. And I'm so unhappy. And she cries and cries and cries and cries. And Jyotila pats her on the back and tries to pacify her. And then she says, you just wait. I will go upstairs and sort this all out. Young girls shouldn't fight so much. So she brings her upstairs by the hand, and she stands there and she puts her arms on her hips and she says, Radha. And I think she probably didn't call her by her name. They have terms always to keep a respectable distance. So she called her and she said, why are you causing so much pain to your cousin? And Krishna's smiling, yeah? And Radha is looking, mouth open, and she says, this is not good. Young girls shouldn't fight like this. I understand you fight, but you have to fight and make up. So I want you to make up. I want you here, take Vidyavali and give her a big hug, make up. And Radharani says, oh, my dear elderly mother-in-law, I have to tell you what really happened. I didn't fight with Vidyavali. Vidyavali and I are friends. But Kundalata fought with her. Now, Kundalata is Krishna's cousin, so they have a different relationship. So Radha says, Kundalata fought with her. She said so many mean words to her, and she was the one that made her cry. Ask her to hug Kundalata instead. And Jyotila says, yes, yes, hug Kundalata and make up. And Kundalata says, no, it's all right. No, she was Radha, it was Radha. And Jyotila is going backwards and forwards. What are these girls doing, backwards and forwards? And she says, anyway, I want you all to work this out. She said, and And because Vidyavali's come here, she's had such a difficult experience, and you girls have been fighting like this, I think that you should make sure she stays here overnight. In fact, she can stay for a few days if you want. She should stay here overnight, and you should just keep her here with you and all be happy together. I'll leave you now. And she comes downstairs and gets back on with her work. And Krishna, of course, is very happy because everything here is meant for his pleasure. So when we hear the pastimes of Krishna in his parakīya rasa, which means when he is enjoying something that does not belong to him, we have to understand first, everything belongs to him. We have to understand, who is he? We go back over our tattva. We go back over our Bhagavad Gita training. We have to regularly go back over our philosophy and say, who is he that he's so audacious? Oh, he's the supreme master of everyone. And then when we think, these pastimes, they're fun and funny, but they're a little bit, I'm not sure about this. If we ever find ourselves thinking like that, then we have to go through this whole process of understanding that this world and its worldly morality is a shadow of reality. And reality means everything for Krishna's pleasure. And this is why we do our Vaidhi Bhakti. This is why we chant. This is why we try to fix our minds on Krishna when we're doing ordinary worldly things. Because whether we know it or not, we're all in training. We're all in training, and we're not in training only to become nice preachers, which we should become, or to become leaders here, which we should become. But we're in training also, because that is only the two balls, Krishna consciousness and material life. But we're also in training one day to enter into this atmosphere, this transcendental atmosphere. And Srila Prabhupada knew that when he was teaching and showing us how to chant, how to preach, how to do so many things to help others. He also always knew what he was trying to do. He was trying to bring us all back to home, back to Godhead. So this place, as I said, is extremely dear to the Gaudiya Vaishnavas who understand its mystery. And it's less rarely visited by those in other sampradayas. So how was this place established? Here's a good question. How did they find this place? Was it always here, like this? Some people say this tree has always been here. But sad to say, last time I was here, which was during the Japa retreat, all the foliage there was up there. So I don't know what is the situation. We can ask the Baba. But if the foliage from the tree can then be on the ground, can then be burnt, can then be taken somewhere else, then is this tree as we see it, is this the eternal spiritual world? We have to understand that there must be something deeply spiritual within or behind or as well as what we can see with our eyes. But this tree is an exceptional tree. This tree and all the trees of Vrindavan are great saintly people. Every tree in Vrindavan is a saintly person who has appeared here. They have requested to be here. They want to do their bhajan. And bhajan means essentially, for us, our bhajan remains at this point mainly our chanting. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his writing, he has given us indication that there should be an internal meditation that accompanies our chanting. And what is that called? It's written in the form of bhajans. So he gives us bhajans to do bhajan. And bhajan means, what are we thinking about when we're chanting Krishna's names? So these transcendental personalities that we can see here with our eyes, They are here in a deep transcendental state of meditation upon the pastimes that take place here eternally. Sometimes they're revealed to the eyes of the world, and sometimes they're covered by what is called the drishyaman, or what you can see with your eyes. So when we come here, we see what we see. We see a temple. This has not been here for a very long time. We see tiles on the wall. Now that hasn't been there for a very long time either. We see so many things when we walk through the village that we see with our eyes. This is the outer covering of the Dhamma. Within, if we were to have the bhakti that is possible and is essential and is each one of us is meant to eventually achieve, then when we came here, we would see somewhat differently. And so again, how do we know this place is what they say? So Lord Chaitanya, he sent Rupa and Sanatan Goswamis. He sent them here to Vrindavan. And one of the main things that he wanted them to do was to relocate the places of Krishna's pastimes 4,500 years before. That's a long time. For example, if you want to do some study of some sort of history and you go on your Wikipedia looking up anything, you'll find it hard for people to tell you anything about anything that happened 5,000 years ago. And if they do tell you something, they'll tell you this is mythological or this is one of the stories that people tell in that place. There's no evidence. We don't have any concrete archaeological evidence that we can prove that that took place. So to come to Vrindavan before the Goswamis, you would have walked around and seen forests and trees and some villages, and you would have known nothing of where was anything to do with Krishna, although he had walked this whole tract of land thousands of years before. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, being Krishna himself, he requested them, go and relocate the different places. And sometimes it is said that they would sleep under a different tree every night, and the trees would tell them what took place there. So this, of course, is a totally different level of consciousness from our own. But in order that people like ourselves could come to this place and have an experience here, they had to come first and locate all the places so that we could come and understand this took place here, that took place there. So there is one great acharya also called Narayan Bhatta Goswami who appeared at the same time as Rupa and Sanatan Goswami. And he was the one who was specifically went around and he relocated the parikrama path so that we can do Brajmandal Parikrama. Before that time, no one was doing Brajmandal Parikrama. So this again is the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to make the Dhamma available to the people of Kali Yuga. So when we come here, we should take a moment and we should pray as deeply as we possibly can that we may remember when we go back to the West or wherever we're going and we're again in the atmosphere where we're juggling our two balls, that there's a third one. And we wish to one day to be able to also keep that one in our grip and be able to juggle the three of them as well. So thank you all for listening as carefully as you have. And I hope that some of these intricate concepts make their way into your understanding. And that I haven't impeded on that journey. And if anyone has any simple questions, please ask. Yes. Oh, that's an interesting question. This is a very good question. Why did they want to get married? Why did the girls want to marry Krishna so badly? They could picture it. We'll walk together. We'll do this. He'll come like this. They pictured a whole marriage. Why did they also want it to be a secret? So the Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives us some insight into this. He has in his Jiva Dharma, he has a question between a student and a teacher. And the student asks, were those girls in Swakiya Ras or are they in Parakiya Ras? Because they want to marry Krishna. And he speaks through the form of his dialogue, and he explains that every one of the girls in Vrindavan wants to marry Krishna. Everyone wants to marry Krishna. It's not like only these girls want to marry Krishna. Every father in Vrindavan wanted their daughter to marry Krishna. Everyone wants Radha and Krishna to be married. Everyone is seeking that. But there's something intrinsic in the nature of Vrindavan that this can't happen. It can't happen. And so therefore, Purnamasi puts obstacles in the way so that it doesn't happen. Because as I said, then Vrindavan would be like Dwarka. Everyone's married, happy. And the main obstacle is, does anyone know what the main obstacle is? A very real one. The marriage will break, yes, thank you. Because Krishna will leave, the marriage will break. So it won't really break. This is not a mundane break. But in the form of Krishna's lila or pastimes, Krishna will go on to Mathura and he'll go on to Dwarka. So inherent in the relationship of the gopis with Krishna is this deep, deep, deep secretism. You'll see the word gopi even means to hide their love. Remember we heard about this? Lord Shiva said, you know, I hide my love, I hide my bhakti. And you'll notice as we go on with the pastime that Krishna tries in various ways to get the girls to reveal their love. And they won't. It's inherent in their nature that they hide their love. So this is something very exceptional. And it's something that we can learn from. It doesn't mean that we have to imitate this, but this is the nature of the gopis in Vrindavan. They always feel that everyone else is fortunate, but I'm not. I cannot meet Krishna. My husband is in the way. There's this obstacle and that obstacle. And this intensifies their love to a super, super boiling point. And Krishna is always making arrangements to step over these imaginary obstacles to meet with them. And this dynamic tension between their mood and his mood is like as if the fiber of the relationship between the gopis and the other residents of Braj, but particularly the gopis and Krishna. For example, the cowherd boys, if you think to yourself, oh, that sounds miserable, you might prefer the mood of the cowherd boys. Because the cowherd boys, every last boy thinks, Krishna likes me best. Krishna likes me best. Every boy is given that conception. And they're very happy with that. And then when Krishna comes out in the morning from Nandagram, Yasoda has dressed him so beautifully and so carefully. They look at him and they think, your mother doesn't know how to dress you. And so they go collect some flowers or some kind of something that they can paint on his face. And every boy will redecorate Krishna according to their liking. So that's the mood and conception of the boys. But the special nature of the mood and conception of the gopis is to remain hidden. So therefore, even though at that moment they're thinking, I want to marry Krishna, we want to marry Krishna, the nature of the marriage, first of all, he can't marry all of them at one time, so many wives. And secondly, he will be leaving. So the marriage becomes in a very secret, hidden way. And they're satisfied with that. That's what they actually want. So Krishna will work out a way to bring about a satisfaction of their longing to be his wives. But it won't be in the straightforward road that you will see in the Swakya relationship. Any other points? Yes, Abhiman actually, I had a quote I can't access on this, that Abhiman means a conception. Right? Abhiman is how I think of myself. So like the gopis, Abhiman is this, we should hide our love. So Abhimanyu exists, there's an Abhiman that the gopis have in the spiritual world. They feel that they always have, there's somebody else, and they have to hide to meet with Krishna. So that's called a conception in Abhiman. But when Krishna's pastimes come down into the material world, where he manifests a birth and he manifests a childhood, then there's also a manifestation of husbands for the gopis. So this is considered to be somewhat like, it's described for our understanding, like Abhimanyu is like a shadow of Krishna. He's no one else. This is the most important thing. He's not, as I said, like in the Christian concept of sort of God is over here and there's Satan over here and they're fighting with each other to capture a soul. There's no competitor of Krishna. This is just another aspect of Yoga Maya's arrangement for the pleasure of Radha and Krishna. So this is correct, yes. Any other good questions? This is a very important point. The question was, I described, and I didn't describe, I repeated, Srila Jiva Goswami described Katyayani Vrat in a very elaborate way. Can that be adopted by our youngers? And the answer is, that's the most horrible thought I can imagine. I can't think of anything worse. Because why would you be doing it? Why would they be doing it? For their own pleasure. So you would be doing them the greatest disservice by doing that. That's why I looked it up, because I was curious. Is this a habit in India to do Katyayani Vrat to get yourself a nice wealthy husband? And it is. But they're not worshipping Yogamaya. You cannot worship Yogamaya. Only the gopis can worship Yogamaya. You would be worshipping Durga. You can't approach Yogamaya and chant a mantra, please make the son of Nanda Maharaj my husband. You can't do that. So you would contravene all the principles of Braj by doing that. And many people do that. So I would like to make that a warning for those who have an Indian background, who might be thinking of the well-being and benefit of their children. The parents of the gopis did not ask the gopis to do Katyayani Vrat. It's not something done for the well-being of the gopis. It's done for the pleasure of Krishna. So please don't ever do that. Introduce this. You may see it happen because all kinds of things happen, but at least you should have a proper understanding of what is the significance of this pastime. Yes. Oh, that's in Jaipur. There, yes, at the time of, after Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, there was a Ramanandi sect in Jaipur were considering that the Gaudiyas and their Sampradaya and this, especially this Parakya, they didn't like it very much. They didn't have a proper understanding of it. We should make sure that we have a proper understanding of it. Otherwise, we will repeat mistakes of understanding. So they thought that putting Radha and Krishna together, previously you should understand, before the six Goswamis, nobody worshipped Radha and Krishna together. You see, we walk into a temple, we walk into the Krishna Balaram temple, and what do we see? We see people, we see deities, we see the 24-hour kirtan, we see some Mahaprasad, we see some books being distributed, and the average person, that's all they see. They just see what is currently there. They don't have the perception to look at, where did this come from? They don't ask penetrating questions. They just accept, because it's here, it must always have been here. Because it's here. But it wasn't always like that. This place wasn't always here. Radharani's worship was not there. When Govindaji came, when Gopinath came, there was no Radha with them. And they came from thousands of years before. They were actually made in the time of Uttara, the mother of Maharaj Prakrit. So they are ancient deities, but there was no Radha. And the worship of Radha was incorporated at the time of the Goswamis. So it wasn't easily accepted by everyone that you put Radha there. What's Radha doing there? Why is she there? She's not the married... they couldn't accept it. Certain sects, not the Gaudiyas. And so there was a king, I think it was Maharaj Jai Singh, if I'm not mistaken, in Jaipur. He had Radha Govinda, Dave, who we can go and see today if we go to Jaipur. They were being worshipped like that. And another sect came and said, this is not bona fide. The Gaudiya Sampradaya doesn't even have any authority for doing this. It's never been done before. We have Vedic authority, and Vedic authority doesn't speak about anything like this. I've never seen any of this in the Vedas. This is all made up. This is not correct. They should take the deity of Radharani off the altar and worship Krishna. And so at that time, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti was residing in Vrindavan, and he was called to go and defend the Sampradaya. But he was elderly, and he sent instead his disciple Baladev Vidyabhushan. And he went to Jaipur, and when he got there, I was recently reading how he had to defend the Sampradaya, and they said, you don't have any commentary on the Vedas. You don't have your own commentary, so we don't consider you an authorized Sampradaya. There's four Sampradayas, and you're something different. And so he went to Govindadev, and he said to him, you have to help me with this. I can't do this. I can't write the whole thing myself. I have no power to do that. And Sri Radha Govinda gave him the words to write what's known as the Govinda Bhasya, which is actually our commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. So after that, by that act of kindness, so then Radharani was allowed to stay by the side of Krishna. So it's fascinating to go back in time, because you realize that, oh, things weren't always here. Oh, there was a time when there was no Krishna Balaram Mandir. Oh, there was a time when there was no Radharani being worshipped. And then what happens is, if you go back and you understand a little bit, your experience becomes richer and deeper and more valuable. So this is why we share, we talk, we understand, and also why we clear up misconceptions. I'm so glad you brought that up. Because I was thinking to myself, oh, I hope nobody's thinking, oh, we have to do a Katyayani Vrat for my daughter so she can have Krishna as her husband. So thank you very much. And please excuse me, I don't mean to be rude to you. But this is very important points. Very subtle, important points about the Dharma, about our philosophy. Without this kind of training and understanding, as Westerners who know nothing, many of us here are, we know nothing of this culture. We walk into Vrindavan and we make one mistake after another, after another, after another, and then we proudly walk out. But to actually understand, we have to have a different quality of heart. We really have to feel ourselves to be, we have to feel ourselves to be very fallen and crude, rather than leading the world in modern technology. And we should look at the villagers and see how they live and say to yourself, could you do that? Could you wake up every morning, make cow dung patties? Could you cook on a gopa fire? Could you load a truck up like this so that it rattles along the road in front of the bus and you're wondering if it's going to fall over? Could you do this? Could you live like this? Could you live an authentic life in Vrindavan? And all of us will probably have to say, no, I can't do that. And it's not that we have to do that, by the way, but this is an antidote for our mundane, materialistic sense of superiority. It's to bring us down a little bit so that we can touch the dust of Vrindavan more easily on our head and our heart. So again, thank you. Yes, Vrajalila. Well, you'd have to be highly advanced to actually live in such a reality. Of course, it's said in a general way. That's not said in a philosophical way. If somebody says that philosophically and they bring out 20 quotes from Bhagavad Gita to prove it, then you may have an argument that you have to take up. But usually that's the kind of thing you say to people when they're a bit hopeless and you try and find something nice to say, something comforting to say to them when life is not as easy as they would like. So it doesn't work for me. I don't say it and I don't feel it. It may work for some, but I think more you could say perhaps if I was really, really pure, I would like to be married to Krishna. But most of those young girls, if they or older ladies, they're not interested in being married to Krishna. They want a human husband. They feel a need of a human being. So it's as I said, kind of just like something that you say. Doesn't have any spiritual essence behind it. Would you like to be married to Krishna? Yes? Huh?
I said, don't worry, you can still be married to
Krishna. We'll keep it a secret. Well, what I found when I was preparing this katha was that I was going to all these details, the details of what the gopis were saying and what they were feeling and what they were wearing and so many little details, and it started to create like, and this is my problem, it started to create a diorama because I'm into dioramas. That's where I come from. So it started to create like something that I could put together like a painting or a diorama. And it, so it had 3D to it. Not just a few words like, oh, it was like this and they were happy. And because normally we say things in ways that don't create pictures in the mind. They create an idea, but they don't create a picture. But everything we're looking at with our eyes is creating pictures. So the pictures are impressing upon us more deeply than the concepts. We need the proper concepts. It's essential. The concepts are like the metal bars. You see here? These metal bars up here? If you didn't put them in, then you couldn't have a roof. But we don't look at the metal bars. We look at the whole building. So the concepts are like the basic building blocks. But then on top of that, we want to have an experience. And so when I can picture it, Krishna was like this, he was sitting here, he did this with his hand, I think, wow, he's real. I mean, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but now he's moving his hand. And then I start thinking, wow. And that means that the story's not a story, it's a leela, it's real? You mean there was really, the Yamuna wasn't like it looks right now in Vrindavan, full of sewer water? You mean it was full of lotuses once? And then all the pastimes, they start to come alive. It's like the lights go on. Or you know how it is on a day when it's overcast and you're outside in the garden or you're somewhere and everything has a touch of grey to it. Or Vrindavan before the monsoon season, everything has a touch of dust to it. And it's nice, but it's not sparkling. But then when the light goes on or the rain falls and all the dust is removed, then everything is vibrant again. So this is actually what we're really looking for. We may have our own ideas of what form that would take, but I think everyone is looking for a vibrant experience. And Krishna consciousness is meant to come to the point of a vibrant experience through proper training, through putting in the metal bars the right distance apart, having the right consistency of cement. If you don't do all the building, build the foundation, build this, build that, then the whole thing can collapse. Or, as we see in Mayapur, there's the odd building that's a little crooked. Have you heard or seen? So this is what happens if you don't put the right effort in to building the basics of the building of your spiritual understanding. But once you've done that basic principle work, then you start to put in all the beautiful things. Like the lady or the interior designer in a rich man's house comes in and designs what kind of light fittings you should have, what kind of floor coverings you should have, what kind of furniture would be very nice for this rich man's comfort and pleasure and to show off to his friends. And that part's much more entertaining and enjoyable than putting in the steel beams. But the steel beams have to go in first. It's essential. So first our philosophy, first our effort and practice, and then that's like a bud. And then it's meant to blossom out into a wonderful experience of our relationship with Krishna in due course of time. So yes, you're dealing and you're dealing also and I'm dealing also with people with human problems. And I tend sometimes to keep the human problem in the area of human psychology rather than randomly mixing in spiritual points and try to help them to become a more responsible human being so that they can become a more responsible devotee in whatever situation that they're in, rather than sort of, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Okay. Thank you again for your patience.